Hello and welcome to Deluded, the Melbourne Demons podcast. Neats, my hardened, cynical demon supporter shell is starting to crack a little bit.
Do you know what? It's taken a while, but you're finally getting there.
It's a very slow process.
It is. It's like a thaw, really. The ice is starting to thaw. No, and to be honest, I mean, it's been a decade, or more than a decade. It's been 50 years, really, of complete mediocrity. So there's a reason for it.
Closer to 60, actually.
Yeah, okay, yeah, 60. It's funny, though, isn't it? Because this is the first time since 1994 that we've been 4-zip.
Yeah. A year we finished seventh.
Apparently. Correct. Yeah. So hopefully we'll have a, you know, we might not, because I think that they won the first like seven games and then completely collapsed. Is that right, Kiz?
Right. But I don't, look, I can't say I really remember anything about the 1994 season, but this team does seem to have a little bit more, I don't know, some guts and resilience.
I think there's real resilience shown. Honestly, in each of these games, I mean, except for probably the Fremantle game, which was pretty clear, but in each of these games, there were passages where the team was really challenged and there were a couple of momentum shifts. And we really have always, come back with a fight. And so I've been pretty impressed by the resilience shown by the group, particularly within games.
Yeah, totally. And look, it's a long season. There's still a lot that needs to be proven. Geelong looked pretty average, but the point I was making to you the other day is I've come out of every game thinking, geez, our opponents are pretty garbage. And then you have to think, are we making them bad? Is it something about the structures or the pressure that just makes these teams look terrible?
Right, exactly. No, and we have to keep in mind, I mean, Geelong are missing Dangerfield and Cameron, which are huge outs.
Sure.
But they still have, you know, Menegola came back into the team. They still have Selwood.
Hawkins on Tomlinson.
And Hawkins on Tomlinson.
No one would have thought it would have been a good matchup for us.
No, no way. But they still have Tom Stewart, you know, who's an all-Australian fullback. Like, there are still some good players who are playing in that team, Isaac Smith, and they still look pretty second-rate in comparison to us, I would say.
And honestly, we could have won that game by like 50 points. You know, the margin was super flattering for Geelong. So there's a lot of exciting stuff. Yeah, I guess we'll just have to see what happens. But we've got a bit of a treat for you this week. An interview with Fox Sports' Tom Morris.
One of our favourites on this podcast.
Yeah, he's an absolute gem.
We adore Tom. We really do. He's the best.
Huge D's fan. Very generous with his time. And we just talked about a lot of random stuff. We talked about Glenn Bartlett. So he broke the news on the Glenn Bartlett story and he had some interesting takes on that.
Talked about Clayton Oliver and his re-signing.
Right.
How close he actually did come to going to Carlton.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about, Simon Goodwin, whether he should be getting a bit more credit for the D's resurgence. Choco, Uze, Salem, Lever, covered a lot of ground.
So this is an absolute ripper of an episode, and I hope you guys really enjoy it. And please let us know who you would like to hear from in terms of interviews on this podcast, because we would love to hear suggestions.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing we've decided on for Deluded in this saturated Melbourne Demons podcast market is maybe something we could bring that could be interesting is just some interviews with some people who have some interesting things to say about the D's, you know, because honestly, you often listen to interviews with players and they can be pretty dull because they're so media trained.
One week at a time.
The boys are training hard and, you know, just that kind of stuff. So honestly,
playing a consistent brand of footy, you know, so we're not interested in any of that, really.
No, we don't like listening to it, so we're not going to do it. But we do like talking to sports journalists and other people who can speak freely and maybe willing to take a few pot shots here and there as well.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of idea, but interested to get your feedback on that. As you know, we're constantly asking for your feedback for all of our kooky schemes and weird segments and all that. So let us know. Nita is giving me a very mocking look, which probably means it's time to move into the interview with Tom Morris. Go D's.
Go D's.
Tom Morris, welcome back to the Deluded podcast.
What a pleasure it is to be back. You don't normally get invited back to podcast because there's so many other good guests out there, but to be back for a second edition is an honour, so thank you for having me.
Do you know what? It might actually be the third edition. I hate to say it. We might have hit you up that many times.
It's an exclusive club.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
People fight for the opportunity to be on the Deluded podcast, let me tell you.
You're basically a guest host now, Tom. It's like it's a step up in terms of your media commitments. Yeah.
Absolutely. So thank you for having me.
So, Tom, everyone who listens to this podcast knows that you are a diehard D's fan, in addition to being an objective, I'm sure, sports journalist. How excited are you feeling about the D's this year?
I'm excited because I think they're finally doing themselves justice, but I'm also wary because I think they've beaten three or four teams that aren't going to play finals. So I'm holding complete judgment until I see more, but it is exciting that you're 4-0, because from 4-0, you really should be playing finals, and that should be the bare minimum of what Melbourne's looking to do. I think the thing I'm most excited about, two things. Number one, I think the ball movement has improved significantly. I think Mark Williams and Adam Uzay have had a big influence, not just on the team, but also the coaches and Simon Goodwin. But number two, I reckon that there's just a bit more resolve within the group. I think the Giants game proves that as well. You know, when the Giants challenged, even when Geelong challenged, Melbourne responded really well. So
even when St Kilda challenged.
Well, that's a long time ago now, but yes, when St Kilda challenged. The St Kilda game was ugly, but I don't mind winning ugly. So yes, I'm excited. I'm not jumping over hoops. I'm not losing sleep at night, but I think it's a very good start.
Well, I want to ask you about one of the points that you made. One thing we find really interesting is there's a lot of talk about Choco and Uzay and how they've come in and revitalized the team and so on. And we certainly buy that. But do you think we should be giving a little bit more credit to Simon Goodwin? We're probably the most critical Melbourne supporters of Simon Goodwin, or in the top 20. But maybe should we be giving more credit to Simon Goodwin at this stage, do you think?
Maybe a little bit, yep. You know, it's all about degrees, and it's a continuum. So you give him full credit if they win a flag, and if they miss the finals, then you're probably sacking him. So somewhere in between that is about right. I think he deserves credit, absolutely. I think he deserves no more credit than Mark Williams. I don't think he deserves any less credit than Mark Williams either. So I think it's entirely possible to pick out a few people like Mark Williams and Adam Uzay and even the captain, Max Gawn, and Simon Goodwin, and say they all deserve credit. So, yeah, I think it's natural that, like it's happening in the Sydney Swan, John Longmire's not getting much credit, Don Pike is. It's natural that people who've been there for a while don't get as much credit as the guys who come in. You know, they're still seen as the saviours. I think that's only a normal phenomenon in cricket. But I think Goodwin's had a good year so far. I think his selections have been bang on. I think the way that he's been able to cover for the loss of Sam Wiedemann and Ben Brown has been bang on. And I reckon it all bodes well. So short answer, yes, but I'm not giving him complete autonomy of credit until they win a flag.
So let's break it down for a second, because people do talk about this influence of Choco and this influence of Adam Uzay. And, you know, Christian Salem has talked about Choco running a kicking program at Melbourne, which sounded a little bit like Auskick, but anyway, putting that to one side. But, like, what specifically do you think they are bringing to the group that hasn't been there before?
I think my personal opinion from speaking to people is Mark Williams' greatest impact on the group has actually been with Simon Goodwin, almost like a coach of the coach, if you know what I mean. Like a sounding board for Simon Goodwin, a senior person that Goodwin's able to lean on, a senior person that's able to give feedback to Goodwin based on messaging to individual players and the group, a senior person that's able to contribute to strategy, that's able to contribute to, the direction of the team. I think that is his greatest influence. I think a secondary influence is that stuff you talk about, you know, the kicking school, which he's big on, and things like that. I mean, but Jordan Lewis has been there 2 or 3 days a week in the preseason as a specialist kicking coach himself. So although Mark Williams has had an impact there, I really think it's advantageous to have still a fairly inexperienced senior coach. I know Goodwin's been doing it for a couple of years, but he's not like a 10 or 15-year senior coach. Having a senior head who's a premiership coach at the club with him, I don't think you can underestimate the value of that. I think that's really important. Adam Uzay, again, I think it's twofold. One, I think strategically, I know at Hawthorne he was rated extremely highly. So I think in terms of strategy, offence and defence, Adam Uzay's had a massive impact. But also I think Adam Uzay, I mean, I know Adam Uzay is a really calm communicator. And I think the way Melbourne played in previous years, we spoke about this on this podcast, it was just too chaotic. And I think Adam Uzay's calmed the team down. He's calmed players down. He's given them, I guess, a formula and a framework whereby, we can be chaotic if we want and we can go quickly and go nuts if we want, but we also have the ability to shift gears. And I think Adam Uzay is very central to that.
And one thing I will say about Mark Williams, which has really impressed me, is his focus on really trying to develop Indigenous players specifically.
Yes.
And his work with Cozzy Pickett, which is so integral in conjunction with Neville Jetta. And you can, you know, the proof is in the pudding when you see the way Cozzy's playing this year.
Yeah. Cozzy, someone asked me yesterday who the three players that you must watch in the AFL, and I'm always a Buddy Franklin fan, always. So Buddy, to me, is number one, just because he's an all-time great. I think Toby Green and Cozzy are equal second. I love watching Cozzy play. I love him because, and I must agree with my colleague Max Lawton, I don't like the consistent comparisons to other Indigenous players. Like, you know, there's plenty of good players out there you can compare him to that aren't Indigenous as well. So it's there's sort of racial undertones to all of this, but he's related to Byron Pickett, so it does make sense that he has a bit of Byron Pickett in him, the way he attacks the man and the ball. His tackle on Joel Selwood and a couple of words to him after was awesome, but also his ability to pick up the ball or be on the ground and stand up without using his hands and keep moving, I just think it's honestly, like, it's just ridiculous. It's what Cyril Rioli did so well. So I think Cozzy Pickett for me is a Melbourne player I just can't stop watching. And I was talking to someone yesterday as well. You know, other clubs were really keen for Cozzy Pickett. They rated him highly. When Melbourne swooped a couple of years ago in the draft, they were really annoyed. You know, Cozzy Pickett, you can build a culture around, you can build a club around. Like, every kid will have his number on his back in a few years' time. So I love that. And I'm sure Mark Williams had a big influence on him as well.
I couldn't agree more. And particularly when you look at North and the fact that they traded with us in order to get that pick. We traded with them to get that pick to get Cozzy. Someone like Cozzy in a North Melbourne jumper right now, despite how bad North Melbourne is, he would bring people to the football. That is someone you could absolutely build a team culture. He would be the marketing, like the centre of the marketing campaigns for North Melbourne for the next decade. But you could get people to sign up to North Melbourne because of him.
Yeah. And the fact that we drafted him is one thing. The fact that we're getting the most out of him is another thing. We have unfortunately, quite a long history in the last, since I've been watching footy, 15, 20 years, of drafting what we think are good players and then doing nothing and then petering out. It's been a unfortunate pattern that's actually plagued Melbourne Football Club, either via drafting the wrong players or not being able to develop them. But it feels like we've got over that now and we're getting the absolute most out of all the players that we've drafted, you know, in the first or second round, which is awesome. And it means that when you have a high draft pick, you actually can get something from it rather than just a player that should be good, isn't, goes to another club, ends up retiring and fades into obscurity, which has been sort of the trend for the last couple of decades.
I think everyone would agree that we've really nailed the draft in the last few years. But one thing I've certainly been a little bit critical of in the last few years, I have to admit, is some of the list management, particularly the decision to give two first-round picks for Jake Lever. He made me look a bit silly on the weekend. Do you think that he's starting to shape up as a bit of a future captain of the Ds?
Oh, future captain's a big call. I haven't really thought about Jake Lever as much of a leader. Not that I don't think he's a leader. I just don't know whether he is the right person for that. Like, I'm neutral on that. But I mean, I agreed with you last year. It's easy to sort of look at, I can't believe we got two first-round picks for this guy. But Melbourne knew what they were getting with Jake Lever, and they just needed to put the right other people around him. And what's happened now is that Stephen May, although he's injured for a month or so, and Jake Lever are like two pillars in defence that you can build actually a flag around. Like, you know, Paul Roos always said defence wins premierships. So, I'm willing to hold judgment on all of that. I always prefer knowing what you're going to get. So you know you're going to get Lever rather than speculating that you might get two first-round draft picks and they might become good players and that might be in a few years' time. You know, it's too many clubs try to pay it forward too much. St Kilda did that for far too long, just get lots of draft picks in and hope they become good down the track. Whereas at some stage you need to bite the bullet and go, you know what, we might be overpaying this guy slightly, but we know exactly what we're going to get and we're going to get a 7, 8, 10-year player who is rock solid in our defence. And I think that takes a bit of courage to do that. So I've also been critical of list management, but I think the Lever decision in the end will pay dividends if they get the right people around him. And that's what they've done with Stephen May. And then the midfield is shaping up well. And then the forward line is moving in the right direction.
And you have to say that Tomlinson's move to the back line has also just added another pillar of stability, right? Like, Levy can do his thing. And even last weekend, he could do his thing because Tomlinson is playing well and he is, you know, he is holding other men. He's holding men accountable in the back line. In the back line.
Yeah, Ned, it was patently ridiculous that Melbourne ever considers playing Adam Tomlinson anywhere else but the back six. Like, when we got him from GWS on a long-term deal and sort of floated playing him on the wing, everyone at the Giants laughed. Like, he's not a winger. You know, he doesn't have the football IQ to be able to do what Ed Langdon does or Angus Brayshaw does or even others do around the league. That's just not him. And that's not even a negative. It's not him. It's never been him. I saw him play junior football. I've seen him play for the Giants. It's never been him to be a link player. He needs the ball in front of him or behind him. So as a forward, it's quite a difficult job. But as a third defender, it actually suits him perfectly. And it was always going to suit him perfectly. So that experiment of playing him on the wing was never going to work. I said at the time, and in hindsight, it's obviously easier. But playing him in defence makes perfect sense. And he's actually quite athletic. So, and in terms of how you see the game, it's a simple role. And it's even more simple when you've got Steve May and Jake Lever beside you. So it's one of those things that, you know, all's well that ends well, but it's a bit of a waste of time trying to play him on the wing because that was never going to work.
That I agree with, yeah.
Tom, I want to ask you about Bailey Fritch's surge this year. For me personally, he's just about the most exciting player at Melbourne, or at least the top three, which I know is a big call, given we've got a lot
give
of exciting
top three,
players.
Please.
I would say Coz, yeah. Petrarca, and Fritch. They're the three.
Hard to argue.
Yeah. And I think Fritch has still gone under the radar a little bit, although that's starting to change. He seems like he can beat just about any opponent. My question is, there seems to be this assumption that Ben Brown will come in, our forward line will just keep getting better and better. One thing I wonder is, now we have so much forward pressure with all of these, you know, quick, smaller players. Fritch is really relishing the attention and getting lots of the ball kicked to him. Do you think it might end up hurting our forward line once we get one of the big guys back, or will it benefit Fritch?
No, I think it'll benefit Fritch because I don't think he'll get the attention that he that he deserves. He's such a, you know, there's always room for these medium-sized players that can mark, you know, because you can play them as a small, really, because of the size they are and their opponents, or you can play them as an undersized tall. Plenty of club, like Brad Johnson's the best example of that, who was a medium-sized player that played tall for the Western Bulldogs because they had no other key forwards at the time, apart from Mitch Hahn. But it's, I think Bailey, the more talent around Bailey Fritch, the better he'll be. I mean, he's had, I'm just looking at his stats now. I know he's kicked goals in every game and multiple goals in three of the four games, but he's had three scoring shots, five scoring shots in the four games. So he's getting looks of goal. You know, he's taking 6 marks, 7 marks, 4 marks, 8 marks. He's a player that I think will benefit with good players around him. So, but there is an unknown about the composition of Melbourne's forward line. You know, I don't know how they're going to fit Ben Brown, Sam Wiedemann, Luke Jackson, Tom McDonald, Bailey Fritch. It is too many marking players, but Bailey Fritch is not the one that falls out. And in fact, he's the one that probably benefits from it, I think.
That's interesting. And what are you making of Christian Salem's season, Tom Morris? Because we are huge, huge fans of Salem, and we think he's pretty underrated at the moment.
Yes, agree with that. I love how you use my full name as
well. I don't know. Sometimes you're a full name kind of guy, you know?
Yeah, like people do say my full name a lot. I mean, I get Thomas occasionally as well. So,
oh, there you go.
And you can call me whatever you want. I don't care. That's fine. I get called a lot worse. But
oh, we know that, Tom.
Yeah, we're not Jesse Hogan. So
yeah. He's a leech. Oh, my God. Anyway, what was I saying? Christian Salem. Now, I work with a guy called Matt Barmer at Fox Footy, who's a journalist. And he went to school with Christian Salem. He was in the same year as him at school at Brighton Grammar. And he often talks about the fact that Christian Salem's first love was soccer, and how he loved, you know, he'd walk into class with a soccer ball, but he'd play footy on the weekends for the school because that's what, you know, culturally that's what you did. There was a soccer team, but football in the APS school competition is really, you know, that's the number one winter sport. So, but watching Christian, and after he told me that about a month ago, watching Christian Salem play this year, I can actually see the soccer player in him. You know, the way he keeps his width, he's very smart, he moves laterally nicely, he's got nice deft touch, like, you know, finesse, delicate skills. Maybe it's just confirmation bias because now I know that he was a good soccer player, but he actually offers something different because he's got that calmness about him when he's got the ball. You know, I almost think of him, you can just imagine him playing at left back, and someone dishes the ball wide to him and he just puts it up the line and then runs on and then crosses it into the box. Like, I can actually see Christian Salem playing that role. And he sort of plays that role at Melbourne, doesn't he, of half-back. Like, he's sort of a link player. He moves laterally. Doesn't look like he's ever too flustered or too rushed. But when push comes to shove, he's able to hit a target and slice the opposition apart. So I agree he's underrated. He was a high draft pick. Don't forget that. He's taken a while to develop, largely because he's physically not, like, you know, he's not big. He's not a physical presence on the field, but he's a very intelligent player, and he's one. There's lots of players around the league that are like this, but he's one of them that benefits from having other good players around him, because they make him look good and he makes them look good. It's sort of chicken and the egg. So yeah, I agree he's underrated. I think he's had a very good year.
It's been fascinating, I think, how the Dom Tyson trade has evolved, really.
Yes.
Because we got Tyson, that didn't work. We got Salem and Hunt. You know, there were times when Hunt wasn't looking good. Now Salem and Hunt are absolutely flying. Josh Kelly is a bit down. You know, we're starting to look all right. And Salem is really the linchpin of it all, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Without Salem, that trade looks like the worst trade of all time.
Yeah, it does. But it did look like a terrible trade a couple of years ago when Josh Kelly was flying.
Yeah.
You know, part of the challenge for the list management, like Jason Taylor and the team, is actually playing a bit of money ball and picking players that aren't going to cost them heaps of money but still play a really good role. So Josh Kelly, at his best, is a superstar, but he's a seriously costly superstar.
Mm.
Jaden Hunt, Ed Langdon instead of Bradley Hill, and Christian Salem, they're not costing you like heaps and heaps of money, but they're playing really good footy. And they're all good for each other as well. They're all sort of similar ages. I heard Simon Goodman speak about Jaden Hunt the other day, and he just said, you know, Jaden Hunt had a maybe was a Goodwin or someone else, I can't remember, saying that Hunt had been lacking form for a couple of years, but he sort of found it again. I'd love to know exactly what he's done differently to find it again, because he was almost on the way out last year. I didn't know what was going on. But Hunt at his best is clearly in Melbourne's best 22, the way he runs, the way he breaks the lines. And I hope he can stay there. And the fact that he looks exactly like Ed Langdon is incredible as well.
It's almost hilarious.
Like they're trying to look similar to each other.
It is hilarious to watch. It looks like you've got twins running around on, you know, on this either side of the wing.
With questionable kicking, yeah.
No. Well, no, Ed Langdon's really improved his kicking. Honestly, we are like the heads. You might be rivaling us for this mantle, Tom, but we are the heads of the Ed Langdon bandwagon.
It's
a big band, but there's not much room on that bandwagon right now, because we love Ed Langdon. That man will run until he can no longer run. He's like Forrest Gump.
I hope he doesn't mind me saying this. We had Christian Petrarca in at Fox Footy last night. He's on AFL 360, and he just showed us like a screenshot of the player's GPS data, and it, like, you know, it's like a, what do you call it? It's a bar graph, you know, going horizontally, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we know what a bar graph is.
But like, not a horizontal bar graph, you know, like the bars are going left to right. Anyway.
Okay. Right. Sorry, got it.
In case you don't know what horizontal means.
Anyway, yeah, exactly.
I don't know why I'm laboring on this point, but the point is that Ed Langdon's GPS numbers are like double as good as any other player. Like, he's just a freak runner. And if you watched on the couch the other night, Gary Lyon actually held up his phone and had Ed Langdon's heat map. I love heat maps. I love seeing where players find the footy. And he's like deep red, like deep on the wing. Like, he holds his width so well, which is perfect for the MCG because it's very hard to defend because it's like a circle rather than an oval. And it's playing such good footy. But again, like, you know, Bradley Hill and Ed Langdon wanted to leave Freo at the same time. The Saints give huge money to Bradley Hill, who is just going, really. I know he's reasonable on the weekend, and we give a 5-year deal and less money to Ed Langdon, who's absolutely flying. He's an All-Australian winger. Again, I don't like to insert myself in the story too much, guys, but I did coach Ed Langdon at school in cricket. And I know the Langdon family very well. And Ed Langdon, and I remember umpiring him at footy and coaching him at footy actually as well, when he was sort of between the ages of 14 and 17. And even at school footy, in the first quarter of games, Langers wouldn't really go near the ball. You know, he's a very outside player. You know, he'd get teased from his mates. You know, mate, you're soft. Like, you have to give him the ball, blah, blah, blah. But by the time everyone got a bit fatigued, second, third, fourth quarter, he would dominate because the game would open up and he would be on the end of everything. And I always thought, oh, it might be a chance to get drafted. I think he broke his thumb in his draft year, so maybe goes as a rookie, gets drafted to Freo. I think, oh, this is good. Gets a couple of games. Oh, okay, this is nice. But But he's exceeded my expectations hugely, and it's almost entirely because his running capacity is just so awesome. He was a gun fielder in cricket. You know, he almost played in the first 11 as a fielder because he's so athletic. So, and he's a really sort of relaxed, laconic bloke who just keeps it simple, just plays the game, which as a winger is awesome. You know, he keeps his width. They give him the ball and he runs and he kicks it down the line and he's improved his kicking. So I love seeing his progression as a footballer.
Do you know what? That's big news for you, Kieran, because Kieran's like other love in life is Ravindra Jadeja, who is also an excellent fielder. And so he's got this real thing for
That is true.
For athletic fields.
Very underrated.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I love Jadeja as well. The fact he's got a couple of first-class triple hundreds is ridiculous. He's going to give him back at number eight for India. But, football, in my experience at school and then connected to the AFL world is littered with players who were reasonable cricketers but gun fielders. Tom Hawkins was a superstar fielder. He was unbelievable, big hands, athletic. Zach Merritt was a very good cricketer, but a superstar fielder. Ed Langdon wasn't a bad batsman, had a nice cut shot, played off his legs quite well, mediums, but he was a gun fielder in the covers at point. And it just shows that if you're going to translate one thing from footy to cricket, it's probably fielding because it's the most athletic pursuit.
Interesting. There you go.
I don't know. We're not a cricket podcast, so I thought I'd give you a bit
of
that.
No, we love it. We love it.
Any podcast with Indians is a quasi-cricket podcast. But Tom, we have to ask you about this. So Glenn Bartlett, you're known as a bit of a newsbreaker, a news hound, and this week you broke the exclusive story that Glenn was stepping down several months before he was due to, I guess, face re-election. I have to admit, we were pretty stunned to see the news because, as you know, we spoke with Glenn Bartlett late last year and he was extremely committed to staying, right, Mitz?
Yeah, when we spoke to him on the podcast, you know, he spoke like a man with real determination and real resolve in terms of wanting to get that, you know, premiership flag to Melbourne and break the drought after so many years. And there was nothing in his tone or in his language that suggested that he had any desire to leave, which is why we were so shocked when we saw the news that you broke. You know, and it was interesting how the story evolved, as I'm sure you'll love this, Tom. You know, it went from very scant details as to why he was leaving to, you know, family reasons. And then it evolved, you know, the details started to come out about the fractured relationships with other members of the board. And then it came out that perhaps his relationship with Simon Goodwin wasn't as strong as it could have been. And then now today, you know, John Ralph is reporting that, you know, sort of Bartlett's come out sort of and defended himself and said that, yeah, maybe he ruffled a few feathers with some of his comments that he's made as president, but, you know, people should just sort of toughen up a little bit. So it's kind of funny how you get these little drips of information and then the real story eventually just comes out.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting, isn't it? Well, first of all, before we talk about the ins and outs of this, did you know that in his speech, you guys were mentioned?
In his speech to...
At the president's function before the game at Geelong, when he announced his resignation,
right.
He was going, blah, 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 you know, I've done interviews with people from Mexico.
Are you serious? Really? That's excellent. We had no idea.
That's hilarious.
I'm serious.
I love being part of resignation speeches,
resignation speeches. So, yeah, that's a small feather in your cap, but he obviously enjoyed that. This was, like all these situations, it's more nuanced. And I didn't, you know, when I wrote that he was stepping down, it's correct. I decided not to include all the details I knew or that I was 80% sure of, mostly because I didn't think the story required it at the time. You know, I'm breaking the story that he's stepping down. That's enough of a shock to people. You know, this is his achievements. Thank you very much. And everyone else can sort of work out what else has happened. But I think it is somewhere in between of the two realities. You know, his critics will say that he was pushed and knifed. His department camp would say that this was a completely voluntary resignation and he decided to just leave the presidency at a time when the club was 3-0 or 4-0 and there was no hard feelings. I think the reality is somewhere in between. I think he absolutely had run-ins and arguments and issues with board members. I agree that Simon Goodwin wasn't a huge fan of him. But I also think that he pushed them on, you know, key values. You know, like as an example, he changed his title from chairman to president, which no one could really argue with. But he was very big on equality and values and ideals that set up a culture of a football club. And he was hard on people who he didn't believe upheld those values. And that absolutely, rubbed people up the wrong way. So I think somewhere in between is probably the truth. I also think that he did a fantastic job for Melbourne Football Club, given where it was when he arrived and where it is now off the field. And I think it probably makes sense that he steps away when they're in a reasonable position. You know, if he doesn't think he's going to be re-elected because he doesn't have support from all the board, then it makes sense he steps away now. It's in the news cycle Saturday, Sunday into Monday. But by Tuesday, Wednesday, it's gone. Kate Brophy's the president and everyone moves on, rather than Melbourne, in a worst-case scenario, being 5-7 later in the year, on the brink of missing out on finals, Simon Goodwin's job's, up for discussion, and then he steps down then. So I think from that perspective, it actually makes some reasonable sense, albeit it was quite a surprise.
Tom, why do you think his relationship soured with Simon Goodwin?
Well, I think what he said about Port Adelaide after the Port Adelaide game certainly rubbed Simon up the wrong way. Albeit publicly, Simon Goodwin just copped it, which I think was a smart decision. I think there's a view in football clubs, it's not just reserved for Melbourne, that the president shouldn't be commenting on football issues, know your place sort of thing, stay in your lane, swim between the flags. The president should work out the organisational structure and, big issue things, but not football specific. I also think that Glenn Bartlett, part of the reason that he maybe frustrated others inside the club was that he pushed for certain values to be upheld really closely. And I don't know whether he had arguments or debates or discussions with Simon Goodwin, but there's no doubt that Goodwin is a realist. He understands that a missed finals series would put him under pressure. The president's all over him. The president's not afraid to sack him. The president's an employment lawyer who probably has clauses in Goodwin's contract that aren't advantageous to the coach. And it's normal to have tension between a coach and a president, especially when the coach is under pressure to keep his job. So I think all those combine into this melting pot of tension between two pretty key senior people at the club. Not saying Goodwin's the one that turned everyone against Bartlett, far from it, but I don't think they saw it eye to eye towards the end. And I think that probably contributed to what some of the board thought as well.
Interesting. Okay.
What do you guys think?
I'm always very... It's funny. When I hear about board disagreements, I'm always a little bit... I always want to know, I suppose, what level of tension is healthy and what level of tension is not. So here's the thing, right? For me, here's the thing. No great organization ever should have a structure or should have people on the board who all see things the same way. That's not healthy because ideas need to be stress tested, right? Like you need to have healthy and robust debate. Otherwise, you live in an echo chamber where everyone sees things exactly the same way and then you don't progress, right? There's always got to be some type of debate and some type of discussion. And it's funny, even watching Making the Mark at the moment, one thing you do see is you do see robust discussions happening. And that's important, right? That's important for things to be stress tested. And so I always guess want to know, when do you get to a point as a board or as an organization where the debate has risen to a point where it's beyond kind of where relationships are actually being jeopardized, as opposed to just there being two people with different opinions and different views?
That's such a good question, and it's whatever the threshold of that organisation is and that group of people. For example, you guys are a married couple, but I'm sure you guys could have like heavy debates, like strong discussions, and be fine because you've got a history of knowing and understanding each other really well. But if there's people
on the board that don't really know Bartlett and Goodwin, but anyway,
but if you don't have that base level of respect for others in the same room, then that can turn ugly pretty quickly. And that might have happened here. Not in a way that was volatile in any way, just in a way that was unsustainable beyond this year. And once it's unsustainable beyond a re-election year, then it becomes unsustainable probably for the rest of the year as well. So, it's whatever the threshold is. You're right, stress testing is such a good word. Glenn Bartlett, unashamedly, pushed people really hard at his football club. And I think after 8 years, it probably became too much for everyone, including Bartlett himself.
Absolutely. And look, obviously, none of us will ever know this, the really deep specifics of the board meetings. Or maybe you will, Tom, but we certainly won't.
but, if I do, I'll let you know.
Yeah, please do.
Please do. But one thing I think we can all say as Melbourne supporters is Bartlett came in after Neild, took us from a bit of a basket case to a really healthy financial position and a pretty good list. And, you know, maybe this year will go as well as we hope and maybe it won't. But I think most Melbourne fans would say this has been a pretty essential presidency in terms of the record.
Right? It's in terms of where we came from to where we are now, it's been unbelievable, his contribution to the club. And that's got to be recognised, right? I mean, look, whether or not his position, you know, his relationship with other board members aside, in terms of what his real primary job was to do, which was to represent the will of the members and represent the will of the people who support the Melbourne Football Club, he's done an excellent job. And, you know, we were very impressed by the fact that he did actually come on our podcast and take the time to do it when a lot of presidents would, you know, suggest that that was not something that was within their purview, even though it is, because, you know, it's a member-owned club. But putting that to one side, it's just... It's important, I think, to remember whether or not that president has actually fulfilled its fundamental role, which is to the members.
Yeah, that's right. And it also rarely ends in a fairy tale, you know. Mm. Like even Eddie McGuire couldn't end his stint at Collingwood in a fairy tale. So I agree with you completely. I'll just ask you both this one. So in his speech, he mentioned this is his speech before the Geelong game. He mentioned that, you know, he's a lawyer, so I don't know how you call what the phrase is. So what you tally up your hours, I guess, as a lawyer, and you work out exactly. Yeah, that's the word. Yeah. Anyway, you can tell I'm not in that space. But he tallied them up, and he worked out that his voluntary hours across 8 years equated to about $8 million of work he'd done for the club for free. Now, he said this in his president's speech. And I just think it's a bizarre thing to say. Like, you know you're going into the football club as a volunteer. You are choosing to do it as a president. You've got lots of other good things that come from being a president, even if it doesn't actually directly impact your bank account. I just think saying that in a president's luncheon is a bit, your last speech is a bit unusual. What's your reaction to that?
So here's the thing. Kieran and I will have different reactions to this, possibly because of the fact that, so I used to, for context to our listeners and also for you, Tom, I used to work at a law firm in the US. So I was very much in this world. And so I understand how lawyers think of every single minute, every single second of their day. This is extraordinarily pedantic and quite painful. But lawyers, particularly in commercial law firm environments, think about every single moment of every single day in terms of billing and in terms of like cost per minute.
Yeah, that and doesn't that's mean just you how just say it in a president's
I agree with that, I mean, but I understand how you probably be thinking that because that's just how all lawyers think.
It sounds like the kind of statement of someone who feels like they're getting a bit jibbed.
Yeah.
And they're not, their contribution might not be recognized, and it's trying to like guard the legacy a little bit. Even the fact that he spoke to John Ralph so quickly, you know, indicates that.
That's a really good point. Guard the legacy. There's no doubt that he tried to guard the legacy. You know, what he said to John Ralph was really him just trying to set the record straight. And I understand that completely. You know, this is his life. He doesn't want to go out thinking that with everyone thinking that he's been knifed in the back. But it's a and I don't think he was knifed in the back in a traditional sense. But I just thought it was a peculiar thing to say, not to think, but to say it in front of a crowd of people. You know. If I'm watching, I'm going, mate, I don't care. This is worth $50 million. Like, you knew it was going to be a volunteer, but maybe that's just me from a non-law background.
No. It's a very fair point. I guess I'm trying to explain why lawyers are so pedantic about their time.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could bill every second of the day. How fun would that be? $50 a minute, you lawyers make.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom, we know you need to head into work. So
no, I actually don't anymore, so I'm able to talk for as long as you want.
Oh, perfect.
Okay, well, I withdraw my last question statement. I want to ask you about the Hawthorn game and specifically about Stephen May being out and I guess what that's going to do to Melbourne. And this is really, I think, the first really big challenge for Melbourne structurally this season. Do you subscribe to the view that Harrison Petty is the best solution, or should we move some magnets around, get Tom McDonald back? What do you think is the right move?
Well, it makes sense that maybe not this week, but maybe next week, whenever Brown or Wiedemann is ready, that whenever they're ready, Tom McDonald goes in defence to plug that hole, unless he's killing it up forward. I don't think it's going to affect us against Hawthorn in round five. I think, I mean, I'd be disappointed if we lost to Hawthorn on Sunday afternoon at MCG, and I'm going to that, actually, which would be good. I haven't seen Melbourne play live since 2019. But the week after against Richmond is the real issue, so it sort of needs to be sorted out this week, because with Jack Rewald and Tom Lynch up forward, we need to have a solution. I'm not sure Harrison Petty is a strong solution, but I think it's probably the one they have to make if they're going to make any at all. So, yeah, it's an issue, but, like, you know, it's a month and it's early in the season and Melbourne's got some cushioning for and north. So I don't think – hopefully it doesn't impact the season too significantly.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky against Richmond, isn't it? This is very un-Melbourne to think 2 weeks ahead after banking the win against Hawthorn. But, I mean – I don't know if you want to play Lever against Lynch or Rewald, even though Lever's playing really well. I mean, on the weekend he was against Jack Henry, and I think that still allowed him to have a bit of flexibility.
So you want to play Lever on the worst, best opponent. So it's like you need a Geelong forward that they're going to hit the ball to, but you don't want that Geelong forward to be too good. And that's really important. Like, yeah, you're right, Lever's not a big bulky key defender, but then in round 8, like, Melbourne play against the Sydney Swans, so who knows if what Buddy's going to be doing by then. And Sydney are playing so well, so you probably, I mean, you'd love Stephen May back by then, that would be ideal, but that's a month away and it's pretty ugly the injury he's had, so who knows.
I do remember way back in the day, like 7 years ago, Tom McDonald actually played quite well on Buddy. He had a bit of a good run against him, weirdly. So
yeah, well, but Buddy, you know, Buddy's never lost to Melbourne. Which makes me sick. You know, he's played 302 games, whatever he's played, and he's never lost to Melbourne. I don't know how many games he's played against Melbourne, but obviously a lot. But that sort of record just shows how bad we were for so long. So hopefully we can end that in round 8.
Yeah. And so the Hawthorn game, you think this is going to be a fairly comfortable win?
Should be. I don't rate Hawthorn at all. I picked them to come 16th or 17th, and that's sort of how they're playing. I think the fact that Clarko is their coach is stopping the embarrassing results. And they almost got over the line against Geelong. But they just don't have that much talent. They've got a couple of reasonable midfielders, a couple of good young forwards. But, the way Melbourne's playing, unless we're complacent, it should be a fairly easy win, I would have thought.
What do you think about their midfield? I mean, because that's the thing. They do have a Brownlow medalist in there. And they've got Jager O'Meara, who's playing pretty well this season. Do you think that that's still not a particularly powerful force?
It's a Brownlow medalist after a broken leg, though.
Right.
So he's not in Brownlow medal type shape, and I don't think he ever will be again, even though he does find a fair bit of the footy. He's never going to be the player he was, Tom Mitchell, just because of that broken leg, which is a shame.
Has he lost a lot of his pace in your mind?
Has he lost a lot of credits?
Has he lost a lot of his pace? And what do you think's happened since the broken leg?
I think Tom Mitchell's just lost that agility that he had. Not that he wasn't known for his agility, but he was very good moving sideways,
right,
in quick steps, avoiding tackles, shrugging tackles. He's a bit more, sounds harsh, he's a bit more of a plodder now than he was. Not that he's really slow or really unable to move, but he just doesn't quite have that energy that he used to. Look at the energy that Clayton Oliver has around the ball, or Christian Petrarca. Like, the way they move, even Jack Viney this year, the way he's moving is just, it's just great to see. So I think I would take Oliver, Viney, Petrarca, Brayshaw on a wing, you know, James Harms. I would take all these guys over Tom Mitchell at the moment, just because Tom Mitchell's not at his best. And Jager was a gun. Like, remember how good Jager was?
But so good.
Jager's had his injury issues as well. So the Hawthorn midfield really shouldn't pose too much of a problem for Melbourne, I don't think.
Yeah. I did see, though, that Tom Mitchell got 19 possessions in a quarter or something on the weekend.
He's finding a lot of little handballs. So he doesn't actually hurt you that much. And that used to be the knock on Oliver. But Oliver's hurting the opposition now, which is important.
Speaking of Clayton Oliver, signed for another 2 years, another very good sign for the Ds.
Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it? I mean, it came out of the blue last night. So he signed on so when he's out of contract now, he'll be a restricted free agent. So that gives him the power. It makes sense. 2 more years. He's probably on good money. It just shows what 4 good weeks does. You know,
he
can see the light. He's like, oh, okay, this is where I want to be. There's no doubt he was restless last off season. you know, the club was never going to trade him to Carlton. But he was telling people, geez, what should I do? You know, maybe I should talk to Carlton, this sort of stuff. So I think it's a great feather in the Demons' cap. They've played good footy and they've been able to lock him in. It's really important to do that sort of stuff early in the year.
So, Tom, let's just go back to that Carlton rumour. So I'm interested in knowing how much truth was there to that speculation? Because I saw a lot of it on Twitter, but I wasn't sure if any of it was actually kind of had any truth to it at all.
Yeah, it's got some truth for sure. I mean, it's a bit like it happens quite a lot in the off-season. Players, it's sort of twofold. Players start to stick their chest out and think, I wouldn't mind feeling wanted somewhere else, you know, just to see what it feels like, you know. And clubs, rival clubs, would like to entertain that. But Melbourne was never, ever going to trade Clayton Oliver. And even though he was a bit restless, he was very frustrated how the season went, along with other players. James Harms was also very frustrated how the season went, partly because he was playing out of position. And it sort of happens all the time. You know, like Zach Merritt spoke to Collingwood. He was never going to go. But they sort of, they just have a flirt. They sort of flirt with, what does this look like? What if I can do this? But it never really happens unless they're actually out of contract or unless it's Joe Danaher, who was adamant that he wanted to leave the year before. So it actually happens more than you think. It happened with Clayton Oliver, who is still a bit rough around the edges, you know, in the way he sort of carries himself, but is fundamentally a good, decent person and a very, very good footballer. But it doesn't mean that he wasn't looking elsewhere. It doesn't mean he cheated. He was just flirting.
Well, okay.
I don't know if it's right, that's the right analogy or not, but you know what I'm saying.
Okay, so this time, actual last question, Tom. So okay. You've mentioned, and I think we're exactly the same on this front, that you're a bit wary about the D's, partly given the draw, I imagine, partly given general post-traumatic stress disorder from 2 years of supporting the D's. We beat Hawthorn, presumably that's still going to be your position. Yeah. What does Melbourne need to do to change that for you? Is it beating Richmond? Is it like, what is it that's going to make you think we actually could win the flag this year?
It's beating a good team in the last month of the season.
Okay.
So even if we're 14-0, let's wait until the last month of the season when all the whips are cracking, all the good teams are gearing themselves up for finals, and let's take a big scalp in rounds 19, 20, 21 or 22, and that would then convince me, okay, we can do it. Because history is littered with, you know, premiership teams or really strong teams losing games early in the year as they just warm themselves up. I mean, Richmond do it every year. Brisbane won 3 flags in a row in 01, 02, 03, and not one of those years did they finish first on the ladder. So they lost games as well. So it's not unusual for great teams or good teams to lose games. What is unusual is for premiership teams to lose games in the last month of the season. So let's wait until the last month of the year. Let's be confident. Let's enjoy the ride. Let's appreciate the improvement across many facets that we've spoken about. But I'm not ready to say that we're going to win a flag until we do something late in the year that proves that we can match it with someone when they're absolutely on and pushing for finals. I think so. It's just a waiting game until then.
Yeah, I'm probably not ready to say anything about that until last quarter of the grand final. Six or seven goals in front, yeah.
Yeah, 10 goals in front. Even 4 goals in front of 3-quarter time is not enough.
So, Tom, thank you so, so much for your time. Again, you've been Deluded's most loyal family member. We're very grateful.
Well, I look forward to meeting you both in person one day. We can go to Cancun or somewhere together.
Oh, I love that. We could go to Cancun.